is, you're going to go first, Nicholas. Yeah, great.
Thanks, Gordy, and thanks to APHA for having us here today. Please, Gordy, do keep me to time, Judy and I to time as we go through this. I will say that the reason that Judy and I are here is really to honor Sarah's work as it's part of Promises. And as someone who's gone through a number of quality improvement projects and have had evaluative partners in those projects, it's so refreshing to have someone who's there throughout the process. And as we think of quality improvement methodology from Deming and Duran and Short, organizational behavior is a very intimate part of that. And so to have an evaluator who's deeply knowledgeable about those aspects of quality and how they relate to improvement throughout the Donabedian structure, process, and outcomes, it's been a real gift. So many thanks to Sarah for all her hard work in putting in the countless hours. So Judy and I are going to share a little bit about what we did with the practices. You've heard from Sarah and Gordy already some overview about the projects. Sadly enough, I have no relationships to disclose. Judy might otherwise, but I don't think for the purpose of this project we have any relationships we'd like to disclose. How we're going to spend the 10 or 15 minutes with you here, really about the intervention, Judy's going to describe that. Talk a little bit about the value of coaching. This is probably not news to any of you, but wanted to share our reflections, as Sarah said, perhaps the special sauce. Wanted to share the learning that comes from that, and then maybe whet your appetite to go and find some of the things that we're developing. As Sarah and Gordy have already mentioned, we want to thank all of the folks who have helped us along the way. Specifically, Judy and I work with the Department of Public Health, but our funder, AHRQ, all the way down to last but certainly not least, the Harvard School of Public Health, which hosts Sarah and allows her to be in a very vital part of our work. So Judy, I'd invite Judy to come up, and she's going to walk you through what we actually did with the teams.
Thank you, Nicholas. Can you hear me? Okay. So, as we mentioned before, we actually recruited 25 practices, of which 16 were in the intervention group and 9 were in control. And as you can see from this map of Massachusetts, most of them were on the East Coast, and we had a few spread out throughout the state. And they were all small primary care practices. Our intervention lasted 15 months, and what we mean by intervention was a whole host of things that I'll show a little bit later. But the coaching that people are talking about today really was Nicholas and myself going to practices approximately once a month, if they would allow us. Some wanted us there more frequently, and some even less than once a month. We did focus on the 3+1. And as Sarah explained earlier what the 3+1 represent, you can see here that we have in a chart format what are some of the what did some of the practices work on. And you'll see that referrals was number one. And based on the survey results, we also know that was something that everybody was worried about. So it makes sense that people would want to work on projects that had to do with referrals. Communications was second, lab results third, and medication management was actually the least worked on project. And again, from the survey results, you can see that most people thought they were doing okay with getting their medication list updated. So what did we actually do when we went to practices? A lot of what we did was building relationships, getting to know the people there, letting them tell us what were some of their pressure points. We offered monthly webinars with key topics that we then would reinforce when we went on our site visits, which could last about 90 minutes. We had face-to-face meetings that actually took 3 hours. And when we started, I know Gordy will remember these well, there was a really big debate about whether or not we could have practices come for 3 hours for anything, let alone once a quarter. I see somebody shaking his head. And actually, it turned out to be the highlight of some of our work with the practices. They really, really enjoyed this. They really, really liked seeing other practices struggle with the same problems and hearing what they were doing about it. Last but not least, Nicholas and I sent out these emails twice a month about whatever topic we're working on, letting them know what other practices are doing about the same problems. And So we call these improvement bulletins that might take them 10 minutes to read. The chart reviews, patient surveys, and staff surveys of course, what Sarah was talking about and Gordy was talking about, and that was invaluable because we had these beautiful reports that we could go out to the practices and tell them what their staff was saying anonymously and what their patients wanted them to know. Oops, sorry. So this busy chart is a compilation of all the activities we did. So in addition to the monthly or more often or less often site visits, all of the purple lines are the face-to-face meetings. We had 6 of them. And in between, we had webinars. And you'll see that we have 14 listed there. Nicholas?
So just as we talk a little bit about coaching here, I wanted to share what we've learned. So in the inpatient setting, traditionally when healthcare wanted to go through its real first phase of innovation and improvement, we started in the places where people were receiving the most care or where we perceived them to be receiving the most care, in the places where the most physicians and nurses hung out, which is in inpatient settings. And in the history of public hospitals in the United States, this is where some of the worst health outcomes were, where poor people went to die. And so we see here that over time, though, that we have certain resources available in the inpatient setting. And some of you may be familiar with this, the Breakthrough Series Collaborative Model, which has been really championed by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. The methodology here isn't necessarily so much important to dive into the details, but the learning here is that these learning sessions, these little boxes at the bottom, are often multiple-day events where teams from, say, disparate hospitals would come together and talk about what's going on and then leave, and a few months would pass, and they would work on whatever issue they have. Well, they would do that within the context of having a quality department, of having on-site risk managers, of having an IT system and hospital IT, and then being driven by regulations and standards. So being able to take your team away for multiple days to a learning session and then go back and work on your own with all of these resources somewhat makes sense. What we learned in the outpatient setting, and this is true of many other places, is that it's not unique to Massachusetts, is that outpatient settings don't have a quality department. In fact, in Massachusetts, we're just trying to get every place of healthcare, whether it's a psychiatrist's office or large family practice, to have someone who is responsible for patient safety. There's not a quality department. There's no legal team. You might connect with your medical malpractice insurer over the phone. Heaven forbid you actually have to see them face-to-face. No IT department. Maybe a big practice has an IT consultant that comes regularly. And here in Massachusetts and elsewhere, guided by patient-centered medical home for a lot of practices. And so Promise is lined up with this. It's basically a gap for these places where they don't have the resources, and coaching fits that need. In very public health fashion, we meet them where they're at, quite literally and figuratively. That's what the coaching was. We would go and meet them where they are. This map of the United States is just showing that in Oklahoma, North Carolina, and Maine, coaching has been happening for a while. Since the 80s and 90s, we've seen specifically rural places taking this work on. Coaches model the extension agent concept, which was popular in the 50s in agriculture. And we've seen that done with outpatient settings, having coaches go to rural places to bring ideas and to spread innovation. They've proven it in other states, and we're just adding to that literature, and we're confirming that here in Massachusetts, if we want to be specific about our own state, and for those of you who are visiting, welcome to Massachusetts, everyone wants to see proof from their hometown. And so this is adding to that literature. We're grateful for those who have done the work before us. Sarah's already mentioned this, but here are some of the quotes. This is, I admit, self-promoting in its own way, but I wanted to show it simply out of the fact that the exit interviews really were here to celebrate Sarah, that Sarah and Gordy led. these exit interviews pointed over and over and over again to the fact that coaches were critical for these practices feeling like they were successful. The quantitative evaluation is going to come in the next couple of months, but you can see with the words of the practices. As Judy likes to say, it's like having a coach at the gym. You still actually have to do the reps, but having somebody who's waiting there for you, oh God, he's coming, I better make sure I get it done. That was the attitude that the practices had. It was helpful, although no one wants to have to do the reps themselves at the gym. So I'm going to ask Judy just take a minute here to walk us through the skills of a coach, and then we'll wrap up with dissemination.
Thank you, Nicholas. So for folks who are interested in this model, their question might be, who would be a good coach? What kind of skill sets are you looking for? And Nicholas and I are thinking about this, and we said number one is a facilitator. And we use that word because we don't necessarily feel that the person has to have a clinical background. You don't have to be a nurse. You don't have to be a physician. But you do need to be someone who can motivate other people, encourage teams, understand that it is a process. It is a system that we're trying to re-engineer here. We're solving problems using an iterative style. And the only way you know whether or not the change is an improvement is if you measure. And so you have to be clever about what to measure and just take a little bit of data so you don't overwhelm people when you're trying to figure out if this change is working or not. One of the questions, again, that we anticipate is that people might say, well, how much of a workload can a coach handle? And that question really depends on how deep versus how wide. And that's sort of a question that each organization has to answer themselves. However, we do want you to keep in mind that as much as Nicholas and I try to get in there to meet with practices, they have very limited time to meet. Most frequently, we met with them during their lunch hour. And therefore, it is not feasible to schedule meetings that are back-to-back. So therefore, there is sort of a real limitation in terms of how many practices a coach can take on. And there are other things that the coach has to do in the case of promises that your coach may or may not have to do, which is the data and the reporting to upper echelons of management. So a couple of key things we wanted to go over with folks in terms of what we learned as coaches. Number one is data. As I mentioned earlier, if you want to know if this change is an improvement, you've got to be able to measure it. And yet the data for improvement work was severely lacking. I don't think there was a single practice that already were measuring things with that framework. Care is fragmented, as you know. Practices spend an inordinate amount of time chasing patients, chasing specialists, chasing test results, and reducing that non-value added work would be a tremendous add in terms of time available for practices to do the work they actually want to do. Leadership. Now, people have asked us, do you have to have a physician lead these improvement projects? And both Nicholas and I have worked with practices where there are physicians who are very involved, and it was very helpful. But it is not the key ingredient. The key person we needed to get involved was the practice manager. And once you have a practice manager paired with a physician, you do get more done. Coaching, as we mentioned before, seemed to be very helpful. And this is based on the exit interviews with the practices themselves, telling us that it was helpful to set a rhythm and a pace to the work, as well as helping them come up with ideas and really doing some team building at each practice location. Some of the key characteristics that a practice that were more successful would have is that they were comfortable with seeing and solving problems. And they would do this as a team. They would test ideas, and failure is not a dirty word. Failure means you learn something. And so for practices that can have that kind of a mindset, that type of culture, they were able to achieve more. And of course, that also involved discussing errors without fear. They actually liked it when we came to visit them. And we also encourage people to steal shamelessly from each other, because why should you recreate the wheel? Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. So the last couple of minutes here, I just wanted to hopefully whet your appetite to see the materials that we're producing in the hopes that if you do work in primary care or you work in a system that has outpatient settings, you might find something that you would want to share with them. So I would advertise that in the next couple of months we will have rolled out all of the materials. We have a little bit now that's available, so you're welcome to view that. We basically grouped it into a few domains. These are the ones that are in normal text are online lectures. All of these are about 15 minutes in length for continuing medical education credit. So the ones that are in normal font are online lectures. It's like a PowerPoint that's narrated by an expert in their field. The ones that are in italics that say case studies are actually they're movies. They're interviews with the teams on the ground to tell their story. So I won't read through all of them for you, but we broke them into domains about the basics of getting started, specifics around communication, because that was the plus one in 3+1, the three, improving processes, and then continuous improvement, so taking it forward once you've got the basics. And you'll see that in each one of these, there are both lectures and case studies, so it's a nice blend. Our hope is that practices will use these, clinicians will use them for continuing medical education credit, but also practice managers may use these clips 10, 15 minutes to spur conversation within a staff meeting or something similar. It's a way to say, look what other folks have done. How might we use this to spur activity in our practice? There is a site down here, and I imagine these slides will be available. So if you don't want to jot down the lengthy URL, you can also access the slides online. I think also Googling Brigham and Women's Promises will also bring that up. A couple of quick notes just so you understand where we're going with the materials. This is one example of a solo practitioner in Massachusetts with a patient of his who, actually Gordy Schiff, who's here, Dr. Schiff took this photo, happened to be there on the day. This is a patient who arguably whose life was saved by the intervention work that Judy did with Dr. Damian Fulch's practice. So, and Dr. Fulch led his team as a solo practitioner. Really pressured them to focus on data and measurement, test a lot of ideas, fail early, fail often, and he motivated his staff. So,
yeah, this patient didn't want colorectal screening. They had sort of written off anybody who just said, no, it makes life easier, but they decided to do an outreach to these patients and send them people called blood cards, and they found a cancer in him, a stage 3 cancer that cured. So it's interesting.
Another example from one of the videos, the case studies, is a practice up in Swampscott. Shown here is Jan, and she led a team with the lead physician to do hemoglobin HbA1cs on site with the practice. So as Sarah actually shared a quote, I wish the blood work had been done before I saw my physician so we could talk about it in the visit. Common complaint, as opposed to seeing the physician, then having the blood work done, getting letters in the mail, getting phone calls, chasing each other back and forth. This team worked on that. How can we do HbA1cs before we see the patient so the visit's more productive? Some of you may do that in your outpatient settings already or similar things, but for them this was new. They did the cost-benefit analysis, really great team, and so we have a video up with them. It's about 15 minutes long, and it just walks through their story. So the last thing before we turn it over here is I just wanted to share the three different buckets that we're thinking about dissemination in. One is to share the curriculum and the tools that we're sharing with you today. Really do hope you get a chance to view some of them. The second is to do what many of you do, is to go to meetings and try to spread the word. And the third is through publications. And again, this is where Sarah and Gordy are really leading the charge. They've already produced some great work on the closed case database about malpractice cases in the state and what we've learned from those cases and how they inform what interventions we take on. But in addition to that, results from all of the information that Sarah shared around patient feedback, staff feedback, the surveys, in addition to hopefully the quantitative analysis if we do find some great results. Last plug here, you'll find on that website when things go wrong. If you are familiar with the original version, it's an inpatient setting. It's guiding clinical teams what to do when there is a failure. And Gordy, along with Lucian Leap, who is the first Don Abedian award recipient, they redesigned it to a four-page manuscript for ambulatory practices, so they as a team could figure out what to do when things go wrong in their setting. So really a nice contribution to literature. Thanks for your time, everybody. I'll turn it back over to Gordy.
So we have a couple minutes for questions for Judy and Nicholas.
I do hope that we'll see the quantitative analysis, whether you have wonderful results or not.
Yeah,
and I hope they will be
wonderful. And I'd be interested in what Judy, I don't think we're holding our breath for a big p-value. I mean, these practices were busy, and it was hard to get their attention. They were doing this on their own time. There was no financial rewards. But as you can see, I think we made some important little inroads, and I think even seeds for future changes, but we may be pleasantly surprised. But let's hear from Judy and Nicholas on that.
We felt from the beginning that there was a high likelihood that there'd be variability in terms of how the practices performed, even though they had, a fantastic intervention that they designed. And so that's why we designed in all the qualitative work that we've been doing. So lots of note-taking as they've been going through with the improvement practices, the different practices around the improvement work, so that we could discern what about the high performance practices actually made the difference. And in part, my takeaway is it's just their level of willingness to engage with Judy and Nicholas. But we have these other hypotheses that we're testing. But we never assumed, we didn't assume the big key value initially, although we're still hopeful.
But that would be very useful to know if in fact you can really detect important cognitive changes that don't show up in a classical analysis.
Absolutely.
That is important. You don't just not publish the one that didn't show anything. You show us that there's a disconnect.
That's the plan.
Any comments from you guys? Another question? Juan and then Al?
Actually, two questions. One has to do with you didn't mention anything about the control groups and just to find out what you did or not do with the control groups. And second, can you describe a little bit more about the practices themselves as the movement towards patient-centered primary-centered mental homes is moving forward, and there is incentives now financially in a number of states.
Sure.
To what extent did the types of practices, was it family practice, pediatric, internal medicine, was it one or five or ten? Were any of them connected to hospitals that were maybe accredited? Those are hopefully characteristics that may have had an impact.
Sure. Harry, are you going to talk about the control sites at all? I just want to make sure I don't.
No.
Okay.
Although Harry is the expert on the control sites, but yeah.
Did you want to make any direct comment about control sites first?
Basically, the only intervention we did in the control sites was sending Harry out there with their survey results. Why don't you comment on that, Harry?
Let me
Harry because he's the next speaker.
I'll speak in a few minutes. So the control site practices, the only thing we did was send some of the results of their patient foundation survey and that survey results. It was helpful for several reasons. One, it incentivized them to participate for the post-intervention survey, so we could use that as a point of comparison for our demonstration practices. But two, it was also important to glean information about how these surveys might be used, and we then used that to improve the intervention with Nicholas and Jerry.
So it is important to reflect that by virtue of sharing the data with those practices at baseline, they did get some intervention,
And for all we know, we may have wiped out our ability to show that it's established the biggest intervention. We did it in both groups.
People were that easy.
So just to complete your set of questions here, the practices that we worked with, they could serve pediatric populations as well, so that it could be family practice, but we were looking for adults as in the work itself. So sometimes the practices had a hard time getting enough patient surveys because they had a large pediatric population.
They had only one practitioner, yeah.
So practices ranged from one provider up to 9, 10. They ranged from more rural parts of the state. Some of them were very closely associated with large medical, academic medical centers. Others, not at all.
Quite heterogeneous. Ali's question?
Yeah.
Laboratory reporting, the measure. Number one, did you encourage people to report not just overlooked results, but normal results? And secondly, did any of the practices have a internet capacity that patients could actually get their own laboratory results?
Thank you for the question. So one of the practices that I, actually all the practices, except for the one that was on paper and was moving on to electronic medical record system, did have a way to inform their patients through the patient portal what their lab test results were. One of the more interesting projects I worked on was they actually said, okay, we're going to track all of the labs that we're requesting for one day, and just see how many of them come back and when and what happens to them. And one of the more frightening things they found was a particular lab test result just simply disappeared. And unless they were actually looking for them to come back, closing the loop, they would not have known. And one of the reasons for that was that the coding at the site had changed, but the practice didn't know. So to answer your question, a lot of these things, they didn't know was a problem until they actually went looking. And then when they found it, they were just quite concerned about it.
Yeah. And actually, as I stand here and think, Aladdin Abedian, we asked whether they had structures in place. Do you have a patient portal? Sarah has that data. We didn't present that from this administrative survey. Process, how does it work? Okay, and then that's Judy. Once we start looking, shining a light on it, it's not working as well as people assumed it was. Or in many cases, they don't even have these systems. Patients signed up to them, and then outcome with these systems in place, are patients actually getting the results? And obviously, is harm happening or not? And that's even harder to measure. But we're trying to look at that whole spectrum. And using your question as an illustration of what Don Abedian's lens allows us to do, we try to get a handle on this, and we found problems, and hopefully opportunities to improve.